So, welcome everybody to the third part of compiler construction. For the ones who have been to the tutorial, I think you now know a little bit better about how to actually set up the Berezetti automaton from the attributes that we have managed to compute for regular expressions syntax trees of regular expressions. And that gives you an automaton that by far isn't the optimum in all cases, but still fulfills a few quite tight constraints in a certain sense. So for our example that we had on the slides, that is the automaton that we are gonna get. So, for the next part we will be concentrating on turning NFAs deterministic. That might have been a picture for last chapter, so that is the kind of an optimized version of the automaton that you've seen before. So you could still do a minimization step on automata in between, or resort to a more advanced concept of automaton construction, like the follow automaton or the anti-mirror automaton. And that would promise to give you even smaller automata than the one that we get out of the Berezetti construction. So this is something that we will not pursue further here, but that will be topics for talks in our seminar in the end of the semester. Well, anyway, we will work with what we get from the Berezetti approach. But although what we have gotten out of that is kind of a small and it's an automaton, we still might ask what we can do with that, because there's still the matter of the automaton needing to be deterministic. So what we see over here, for example, has a part of non-determinism in there, as there's edges that are labeled with A that are going out of the first state, and with that you already have a non-deterministic branching that you might not like to implement, because machines need to be told definitely what to do. So, what usually comes into mind when you talk about making a non-deterministic automaton deterministic is what you probably have heard of already in your theoretical computer science lecture, would be the so-called power set construction. So, is there anyone who does not recall what that actually is? Oh, that's handy that I put a slide together for you then. So, power set construction feeds on the concept of creating combinations of the sets of the original automaton. And these combinations are based on all the states that you can reach through the same input. So you would try an input, see what states might be reached with that particular input, combine them all into a new state of the power set automaton, and continue from that with whatever you can reach from that part, and step by step come up with an automaton that then is deterministic with respect to the input that it interprets, and consists of combinations of the states of the original the original automaton. Thus, it obtains its states from the power set of the states of the original automaton. That's why it's a power set construction. In practice, what you would do is you would start from an initial state and assume that you would start in your NFA from all the states that are marked as initial states. In ours, there's only one, so that makes life already quite simple. So that is the start state. And then what we do is we track states that we reach from the start states, in our case the start state, and record whatever we can reach with that. So, for example, we see that as choice for viable input for that automaton, we can choose from A or B. So let's, for example, check what we can reach via A. So we introduce an edge saying A in the original automaton. This would mean that we could reach states 0 and 1. So, 0 and 2, sorry. Thank you. So, we would create an automaton combining those two together. So this would be 0 and 2 as our new state. Very nice. The other chance that we had was, for example, going B from over there. And, well, that only leaves us with one state to be reached. That would be state 1. So that is also a viable combination, not combining anything, but yeah, that's one possibility for a state. Then, since we run out of things to explore in terms of edges or transitions going out from our initial state, we then continue with what we are left with, and that is, for example, this power set state 0, 2. So, how do we track that? Well, essentially, all we have to check for is edges A and B, because these are the edges from the only edges that occur in the original automaton. So let's do that. So we can, for example, check what we can reach with A. So, of course, this state 0, 2 is not present in the original automaton. We can't directly check what can reach from there, but we can reach what we can check what we can reach from each of the individual states in the original automaton. So we can check what we can reach from 0. That would be 0 again and 2. So 0 and 2. And going A from the original state 2 would give us, well, 3. And with that, we have exhausted all the A transitions from the states that we could reach there, and that leads to a new state. Yes? I did not really get that acoustically. So,
shouldn't you also mark it as an exit?
That's a good input now. The question of accepting states. And since on one path through the original automaton we have reached an accepting state, we should still reflect that in the behavior of our automaton here. And in case that the original automaton would have reached that accepting state, would have accepted, and since one path in the automaton suffices for accepting an input, we should reflect the same behavior in there. So if we reach, or if one of the states that we reach in this power set construction is a final state, we mark the power set that we get here. Well, not the power set, but the combined set that we reach here as a final state. It's all due to this condition of it suffices that there exists one path in the original thing that that accepted.
Can we also not have a repetition on 0 to itself apart from this transition?
So, you mean this one?
Yeah.
Well, this is reflected in the part that we've...
Let's say, you know, the language is A.
The one of the input words is...
Yeah, so you need to go through the loop, right?
Yeah, well, how the loop that we had in the original automaton is reflected in the new constructed power set automaton. And the thing is that we're not really done yet with constructing that thing. Particularly, you see there's still a zero in that thing. And if we continue doing like, well, trying to explore what we can reach with A, let's do so from this combined thing. So this is 0 to 3. And from 3 on, there's nothing that we can reach other than what we can also already have reached with 0 and 2. So this will lead to the A being attached as a self, as a loop edge to that one. So it's not found at the same spot as before, but it still has the same input lang, well, input word as the original one. So that is where your loop goes. And yeah, in the same way, you continue with whatever B is giving you from 0 and 2, which would be, well, for one. For once, 1 and 4. Did I get everything? I guess so. 4 is also a final state. So, like this, and so on. And this would lead to, well, we have an animation for that, so you don't need squiggly lines, but can read that more properly. So, 0, 2 was one thing. Then there was this 1 that we have constructed. There is also the loop, which is now directly put over there, because now we can do that. It's just a singleton state. A goes back to this one. Then we have this loopy 0, 2, 3 from before. Then there's the 1, 4, and it turns out that there's not a lot of other states that would have been created by that. So we were already quite done.
Maybe the question is kind of dumb, but I want to ask anyway. Why do you...
The thing would be that if I don't know how good you can still remember the first tutorial sheet when we talked about implementing automata. So a kind of easy to do implementation would consist in just storing the state of your automaton in as one integer number or one E number presentation or whatever you'd like to choose, but it needs to be a definite thing. Otherwise, you would have to keep a state of thing, which would be an unbounded, well, set, so to say, that you would need to keep. And this would make each of these steps more tedious, since you would have for each of the things that you would keep in your state set, you would have a lookup. So, yeah, it turns the runtime of the automaton really, really cheap, in the sense that you only have to keep track of one state and you can implement it easily with that two-dimensional table lookup. So that's the common way of representing that. Of course, you could also try to not do the construction of the deterministic automaton. That is... well, while at first it seems a little bit odd to not like the one integer memory for your state, it's actually particularly since we do a power set construction and have an exponential blow up of the state space of the thing, and the original automaton might be quite small due to it being only as long as the regular expression has been, it might be more sympathetic. But that just kind of pushes the complexity away from the construction into the actual runtime. But still, you should still keep in mind it's not a bad idea in that sense. We will come back to that a little bit later on. So, power set construction that gives us a finite automaton with which we can, in the end, represent an automaton that recognizes the same thing as our original regular expression. So that is the formal construction of the power set. So what we have done informally, we can do also in a formal way. So the state sets is the states are taken from power sets of Q. So any combination of states from the original automaton. The start state is the set of start states of the original automaton that can be directly taken as in the new start state. The final states are final states if any of the members of the current set has been taken from the set of final states. So it suffices that one of the states has been final. So that's what we say over here. And then it's still a question of what are the transitions in the automaton. And, well, turns out transitions are defined in the way that, well, if you start from a state Q prime and go with A, what you do is you take a look at each of the original automaton's states from inside of Q, and just look up what you can reach when going A. This will give you a few Qs, and you combine these Qs. Is that what would I actually do? Yeah, these Qs are combined into the resulting power set. So that's the construction for the power set automaton. So now we have already hinted what the properties of this construction are. So particularly what we have observed with and what is bothering us is that this construction, though theoretically completely valid and yielding a finite automaton, which is would be quite nice to implement, what we encounter is that there's exponentially many power sets of Q, meaning that the state space for our resulting automaton is taken from an exponential set, which might be not what we would like to have in a concrete scanner generator, particularly since we will have a lot of regular expressions usually used for programming language all combined together, which gets quite a large automaton in the first place. And, well, yeah, making that deterministic renders it even larger. So there are several ideas of, still coping with that. The one thing would be, for example, not consider the complete state space for generation of my automaton, but to consider only those combinations of states that are actually reachable from the initial state, and only create them when they are actually at one point reached in the whole thing. So that's kind of a by need construction, which will keep your memory from filling for quite some time. But still, the worst case boundary for that is quite a large one, as well, In the worst case, you might exhaust your complete state space, and it still gives you an exponential number. It's just that there's a lot of practical cases in which this is not the case. Does not mean that you will never run into that problem. So, yeah, when I say that does not happen in practice, if you have something as far spread as a scanner generator, you can imagine how many times that is used at certain places. And still, if there, if it's not exploding in a lot of cases, you just need to use it often enough for different cases to at one point reach an example for which it actually explodes. So from the perspective of a tool provider of a widely used regular expression engine, you might want to consider to prepare for this incident. And so people like the ones who have written something like grep, which is a widely used tool for creating automata out of regular expressions and is used quite a lot in operating systems programming, well, scripting basically, but anyway. In those tools, what you actually do is you will usually not do the construction of the deterministic automaton, but, well, at least not the complete construction. So what you usually concentrate on, well, you could do, for example, this simulation of the non-deterministic automaton with having a set for the current state. That would be one possibility, at the cost of having to check the each of the components of the set at runtime. Or go the other way, that is the one listed over here. So what you do is you not only leave the states away that are not actually reachable with any input, but you leave the states away that which are not reachable with the particular input for which this instance of the program is started. So you create the deterministic finite automaton, not upfront, but you generate it each time for each input, and not completely, but only the fraction of the deterministic automaton that's actually needed to process that particular input. In our example, so we would have the deterministic automaton somewhere, the non-deterministic automaton somewhere in memory, and would have the particular input AB, AB, for example. So in the construction by need, what we would do is we would not exhaust the outgoing transitions, but only use the ones that are actually taken. So first, from the start, we only generate what we can reach with A, which will lead us to this combination state 0, 2, like this, consuming the A. Continue with B, for example, which will lead us to generating that fraction of the automaton, leaving out this 0, 2, 3, for example. Then take the A, and with A we would reach a state that we have already so far generated. Well, the more savings, the better. So we have that already in our representation, can use that. And we see that the last input, for example, is again a B, which will lead us back to the original thing. And you see, now we have only created a fraction of the states that the original automaton eagerly constructed for all possible inputs would have had. And well, with that you get complexity bounds somewhere between an exponential of the original regular expression and the length of the processed input. But since you have to process the input at once anyway, well, that is probably good enough for your purposes, because, well, you have to invest that anyway. So with that, you kind of have a nice approach to to come to a implementation for your regular expression that can be directly run on your machine and does not exceed your memory boundaries. So, yeah, you can, well, for practical purposes, you would probably need to apply techniques like hash tables in order to check what things you have already created and what not, and all that. You would have to check that for, well, whether a state already exists or not. And yeah, but that's kind of practical issues that you have to consider in with that respect. So, yeah. All in all, what we can do is we can compute a deterministic automaton that accepts the language of the regular expression. So, now that we have clarified the handling of regular expressions all the way from the abstract specification through what we can generate from that, through how we can implement that generated thing, we can have a look. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you from the start.
When do we use comparative, or when do we use the width of transaction? How do we use
that? The power set construction, when we use that?
No. When do we use the comparative and the very steady?
Well. So the question was probably the differentiation between when we Thompson and when Berisecki. Yeah, I might have misled you a little bit last lecture because I was not talking too much about that in particular. So today in the morning I talked a little bit more about that. So that was Thompson's algorithm, you might still recall that. It has these nice little diagrams of things. Actually, what I present here with the Berisecki approach is nothing different than this. The naive Berisecki automaton gives you something really comparable to what you get out there directly from the Thompson's algorithm. What the sophisticated version of Berisecki gives you is the result of optimizing away all the epsilon transitions from Thompson's approach. So if you are unsure about what you how you would accept that, then for example take a look at the way that, for example, this either or is working. There's a particular pattern involved where you connect to each of the alternatives from a start point and from an end point. And this is almost directly reflected also in the Berisecki approach. I've refined the slides a little bit as they're looking a little bit different from the last time, but particularly this part where the subtree is an alternation. All the transitions that are going between the level of the operator and its operands are actually exactly the same that you had in the Thompson's algorithm. So there's the epsilons that connect to the sub-expressions automata and the epsilons that connect back to the exit node of the father node. So it's nothing different. It's just put into the... Sorry? No, there. These are epsilon transitions that you see here. These pink things. But this is just kind of making it more formal in the sense that before you had to hand waved the connection of the operand precedences and the actual way of connecting each automata to the next one. Here I make it explicit by working on the regular expression syntax tree, which gives us the hierarchy of all the operands in there. And what you see here is pretty much the same thing as the Thompson's algorithm would give you if operated on the same thing. So why do I do that? Because with this particular view on the matter, I can motivate you to in the end, come up with this optimized version that does all these computations, which when correctly applied gives you a lot of information that helps you in connecting all the epsilon edges together into edges that have only labels from the alphabet, thus optimize away all the epsilon transitions from the Thompson's construction. So, well, it's the same thing basically. It's just that with this kind of chain of actions, you come up with an algorithm that directly from the specification of the regular expression gives you the already optimized optimized automaton. So it's not a matter of applying one algorithm or the other, because they are the same actually. You could argue that the Thompson's construction is probably preferred if you do it on a blackboard, because you can then strip it around and remove these state markers and just connect them, throw away other edges. So this graphical notion of connecting it might be better suited for blackboard work, for example. But it's essentially the same algorithm. Yeah, with different numbers of states, thus blowing up in a different way. If you optimize them, you end up with the same automaton anyway, because the sophisticated Berry-Sethi automaton gives you exactly the optimized Thompson's automaton. So, you wanted to say that?
Yeah, maybe it's just too good to remark, but I was thinking if you use the attributes, then it's more efficient to compute them like bottom up or top down. If you want to do it like afterwards, after the function, to remove the epsilon edges, is it then less efficient, or are those things having the same efficiency or less?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean when you say applying the computations after Thompson's.
So if you do the Thompson's algorithm and then afterwards you want to remove or get rid of the epsilon edges or transitions in your automaton, then you have to do that in a certain way as well.
Yeah.
Is it equally efficient as doing it in one time, or is it?
I think that, well, you're having three times the walk through the syntax tree, so it's three times number of operations in there. While you compare it with, well, essentially also a constant over a constant factor on the number of nodes. Well, it's just a matter of getting all these updates right. And here you have an application of the attribute systems thing, which we'll see later on. So that's why I do it like this. So I think performance-wise, it's probably not. In terms of complexity classes, it doesn't really make a difference. Okay, so where did we stop? I think it was somewhere here. We went along with scanner design. So the question now would be how to come up with a comfortable software component that enables us to provide this facility that gives you the possibility to declare your token classes and then to somehow react on the act of recognizing the input to confirm to these classes. So what you usually find in these scanner generator systems is, well, a lot of bollocks and a section where you have the actual assignment from token class describing regular expressions to concrete actions that the system should perform when a certain input is detected to belong to the token class defined by the regular expression from before. So, yeah, that's usually it. If you, well, in the context of a scanner generator, what you will do is usually set up several of these token classes to be recognized in your input. Thus, you have the need to specify them all and to give a reaction code to each of them. So you have a list E1 to EK of regular expressions and actions, action 1 to action K, to react to each of these things. The question is, if you denote that, what do you actually mean the system to do with that? And what you would usually expect a scanner generator to produce would be a component that tries to find maximum prefix of the input, maximally long prefix of the input that satisfies the alternation between all these regular expressions E1 to EK. So the priority of the scanner produced from the generator would be not to try to find the token class that is used utmost in the list, but it would try to maximize for input length that can be classified with any of the regular expressions present. And with that maximal prefix in mind, what it will do is it will try to find the minimum number or the minimum index of a regular expression that matched that particular input. So it will maximize the length of the input detected, and with that it will then try to find from whichever a regular expression that matched with that particular input, it will try to find the one that is that has the minimal index in that thing. So if you have found a maximum match that matches E2 and E7, E2 will be the one to be associated with that input. So there is priority involved, but only on second place. The foremost priority is on maximum length of input. So if that is determined, then the action that belongs to that particular index is triggered. Usually what you will find there is a block that you can put user code into with a certain API that can access the actually matched pattern as the in most systems that are somehow related to these old Bison no-lex parsers, where this would be something like yy-lex. So this is kind of pre-given function that will return the actually matched input, and then with that you can do something. And what you can particularly supposed to be doing is, for example, then using that to convert into, for example, a number, and then return your structure of choice that that encodes your token class data structure, instantiated with that particular piece of input together with token classification. Remember, token is not only the fragment of input, but also its classification. In object-oriented systems, you might directly create an object of the class, of the token class, with the match as parameter. So that is usually what you would do in a chain of layers that you find in a complex compiler. If you, for example, do something like a syntax colorer, what you would do is you would essentially give back the string that you have matched together with color codes surrounding that. So, for example, HTML color codes you could put around, and with that you already had your syntax colorer. So, if you know how to do regular expressions and scanner generators, syntax coloring is usually not your largest problem that is out there. So, anyway, in order to get that functionality of maximum match and priorities of regular expressions and token classes, what you usually do is you create the automaton for the combined regular expressions in an alternation. So the automaton for E1 to EK, and then interpret the final states that you reach depending on the regular expression that they have been formally associated with. So you evaluate the final state that you get, for example this Q, and if Q contains a last state of the original E1, which had a pretty high priority, remember? Well, the highest priority of all, then you would define this state as part of the final states for index 1 belonging to the original expression E1. Same you would do for the next layer. So you would consider a Q being an element of final states without the previous final states. That is what you would would have a member of the last states of E2. Then you would assume that to be a final state of regular expression 2. And with that, you would classify the final states of the mother regular expression as different final states for the different components of that alternation. And so if we in the end come up with a particular input and want to know how that is interpreted, we can check all these final states that we have created here, because they don't overlap anymore. We can just check them for which of the regular expressions are associated with them. So that is kind of a clever use of things that we have already computed anyway, particularly these last things, to also help in classification of the matched input. The only thing that we have not thought about right now would be the longest match. But that is also, if you think a little bit about it, it's not that hard. What you would do is a trial and error approach, in the sense that you would try to manage a twofold execution of the input on the automaton, in the sense that you would keep a backup of successful matchings in one set of your runtime, and in case that you can't match anything anymore, you would take the last successful match as your longest match. So you manage two pointers and related states AB and QB. While pointer A points to the last position input after which a final state was reached. So that is this notion of the backup pointer. and pointer B, which tracks what the current input would yield as a state. So, as an example, when running, for example, we would at one point have already successfully categorized fraction of the input. So we would start the algorithm with the backup pointer pointing to the beginning and saying, well, there has not been any match so far, so that is just some kind of null pointer or anything that signifies it's not a valid state, and start interpreting the rest of the input with the start state of the automaton, and then progressing through the input. Each time that we reach a final state, we would back it up into our backup pointer. For example, well, it's just a made-up Q4 because I haven't given you the automaton for the language over here, but assume that this Q4 would be a final state, then I would back it up in there. And in case that I reach a fraction of the input then, that is not a final state, I would continue until I completely run out of options of doing transitions in my automaton other than failed. And with that, I would recognize, well, I can't do any transition anymore. That would be valid at that point. I need to backtrack to the last position where I had a successful match. Take this Q4 as my classification information and interpret the complete part of input up to the point where we are pointing to with our backup pointer as what I have found as my longest match. And with that, you can kind of hit a final state and speculatively continue reading. Maybe you reach another final state, and as soon as you reach it, you you shift your back up to the next thing, and so on. So that is the idea for performing this longest match. Okay. That was probably not that difficult, I guess. Yeah, good. So, another thing that you might find in practical scanner generators is the concept of scanner states. That is kind of a convenience construct that that you can introduce in these things. So, apart from plain lists of regular expressions and their associated actions, what you can do is you can group them together into well, lists of these things that are considered to be all happening in one kind of more general state of the execution. And for all purposes, you would stay in that group of regular expressions during your scanning process until you explicitly instruct the runtime to switch over to another one of these states, switching over to a completely different regular expression and actions group, which would then yeah, you are looking for what should that be, but Wait a minute, maybe. And you would then remain in that section of the regular expression action group until there's an explicit way back. This would kind of give you kind of clusters of automata that by themselves only live in their world until you explicitly cross boundaries to the next thing. This gives you the chance to scan your input with a little bit of context information. For example, you might encounter in a standard programming languages at one point a symbol that would trigger the begin of a comment, for example. In a comment, you might find character sequences that usually would trigger you to return things like keywords, variable names, operators, whatever you have in your language. However, usually you would not want to classify the things that the user has commented out as actual components that should be interpreted in the host's language. Instead, you would like to ignore them, maybe, or even filter for your documentation tool, or have some kind of meta instructions in there for your fancy code generation tool of choice, whatever you can imagine there. So for those purposes, we'd like to switch from your original set of or list of token classes to something else that maybe only registers for the end of comment tag, and all in between would just, well, we would just ignore it maybe, or well, dump it into the documentation repository or whatever you would like to do in there. So that would be a use for scanner states. The other thing, for example, would be strings. If you have a string in your language, you kind of escape from the ordinary scope of your program, and if you use, for example, a keyword like while being in a string, that won't trigger a new loop, for example, but would be maybe printed out as, or something. So for that, you would also not want to return a token of type keyword. So, yeah, a lot of argumentation, but it's for practical purposes. You would like to not have your regular expressions for strings to be cluttered quite a lot, but instead you would just go for an easy escape character sequence like backticks or slash star or something like that, and then go into a completely different mode of scanning. So how would that look like? For example, like this. You would in general specify a name for your scanner state. In there you would have a few regular expression action pairs living happily next to each other. And then you could use special API like this. In this Lex world, you would have these YY prefixed things being from the library of Lex. In that case, with this YY begin, you would do the transition to the state that is identified by the identifier that you use in brackets over here. So this would, for example, transfer control to the, well, I don't have a state one over here, but whatever has been mentioned, you can check over here and then continue with that particular set of regular expressions and actions. So, yeah, that would be it usually. You would have to return by another call of yybegin. In our case here, we have this comment thing where you have the regular expression that is just slash star. You would transfer control to the comment state. In the comment state, you would only react to, well, not like this, react to the star slash, which would lead to a transfer control back to the original scanner state. And in all the other cases, you would do the catch-all, which is a simple full stop, or carriage return. And those you would probably, well, in our case, we would just throw them away, but we could do meaningful things like fancy documentation or whatever. So that is scanner states for you. In terms of implementation in an actual scanner generator implementation, well, you have the automaton anyway. You can introduce these arbitrary edges by some means. That would be a possibility, but also you could just keep several automata and kind of switch between them with this particular with the code that is given by this YY begin or whatever. So that's all perfectly viable for you. Okay, so is that something that you want to acquire more? No? Shouldn't be too difficult. So for you at home, the all matching full stop method YY begin to switch. Yeah. Well, all that you see there can be also directly implemented with regular expressions, of course. Well, having a stateful scanner is not too different in terms of expressivity of having an ordinary scanner with more complicated classes. So, yeah, it's not kind of exiting the original expressivity and open a new world, but it just facilitates specification of a practical scanner. Yeah. Well, with that, if you don't have any more questions on the scanner part, I'm sure at one point you will find something like that also in the tutorials, then I would go over, close that particular phase of the compiler and start anew with the next phase. So if you remember, there was this layered approach of syntax analysis in a compiler, which would start with classifying the input string in form of transferring it into a stream of tokens and the, including the classification. So the next part in line would be working on the result that we've produced in the last phase, meaning the token stream. And the purpose of this phase would be to detect hierarchical information of the specifications that we have been given to in the input, which would, for our purposes, mean we would like to obtain the syntax tree of the input. So what would be typical hierarchical information of our program? Well, for example, you could have hierarchies in the sense that in an object-oriented language you have kind of the concept of class definition dominating a lot of method declarations or attribute declarations. You could have something more down to the actual body of a thing, like a while loop where the condition dominates, for example, then the body, the actual body of the loop, for example, by, which could then be further specialized into the actual statement list that makes up the body of that particular loop, which by themselves could can then be seen as different kinds of statements, like other loops, like expression statements, like what else is there? Like branches, branching statements or something. So yeah, that's all kind of thinking in a hierarchy. And yeah, so that would be typical units of interest in the syntax tree, for example. So in the same way as we have had that for the scanner part of the syntax analysis, the parser component is a thing that has certain resemblances throughout all the implementations of compilers that are out there, and usually follow similar concepts and have similar implementation techniques involved. Once again, it's a thing whenever you have realized what you would like to do there, you could probably get a real bored doing that, because you all the time use the same patterns. You use them a lot in order to encode a complete parser for a programming language. So you would like to maybe try to abstract away from the concrete implementation of your parser as a component to a more high-level specification of what you would like to do. So what you would be looking for would be a way to specify how syntax trees of your language look like and have the system come up with an implementation for a parser that actually provides this particular kind of syntax trees. So, once again, the idea for a generator-based system with specifications for the syntax of a language as an input and an actual implementation for the parser as an output. And in the case of syntax analysis, what could be used there? Well, a typical way of specifying hierarchies would be, like in spoken language itself also, grammars, particularly context-free grammars. So that is something that you would like to use as a specification of your language's hierarchical structure. Give a grammar for that. And, well, what is a machine model that is as expressive as grammars are? Well, usually what you will find in that area is a type of machine that is a pushdown automaton, essentially. There might be a little bit more to that than just a pure pushdown automaton, but in principle, in general, it would be some sort of pushdown automaton that you could generate from that. So that would be the goal for that particular part of the syntax analysis. So, since we need a common ground to start from, we need to clarify what we mean when we talk about context-free grammars. So, yes?
I have a question regarding the lexical analysis. At the beginning, we mentioned that after the scanner, we have the so-called SIVA, that we manage the string pools, the name handling of the variables, and so on.
You could have something. Not all concrete compilers actually have an explicit siever component in that sense. It's some in many instances. It's just somehow woven into the scanner component. So it's not a must-have component, so to say. But
okay,
yeah,
this would be before the syntax analysis.
That would go before the syntax analysis. Yeah. You don't need this hierarchical information to perform the tasks that you would do in a siever. Also, a thing that I might want to mention that in principle, with regular expressions being expressible by context-free grammars, you could argue for the case that, well, if what all that we do in the scanner is expressing things that we can express with context-free grammars anyway, we would not just use context-free grammars from the start for everything and get rid of this kind of pre-processing phase. You're right in the sense of that this is just a subset of the expressivity that we use for this phase now. However, this pre-processing has, for example, also the purpose to try to soften the blow that goes to the parser in the sense that it reduces the number of states and the complexity of running the actual parser later on, because these finite automata are quite performant, and if you have to use this stack-based approach of the pushdown automata, you will have worse performance for once. Also, specifying the things that you can specify with regular expressions with grammars blows up your grammar size quite a lot, since grammars are kind of, well, regular expressions are more flexible beasts for these small units of interest that the tokens are. And you can, for those purposes, you can write your classifications more concise. So That's what you usually choose for that. But there's also a few of those generator approaches out there which only use context-free grammars, and perfectly valid, can do that. It just has certain implications on the actual runtime then. Anyway, I hope that answered your question. Yeah, good. So, basics of the context-free grammars. So, first of all, what we have to clarify is when I talk about these context-free grammar things is that they usually are talking about some atoms, so-called terminals, that they are defining hierarchical structures on. And in this multi-layered approach, having the scanner as a face before, the syntactical rules are not speaking of direct input characters anymore, but instead they are already working on the given pre-classified tokens. So the hierarchical rules are specified on the level of tokens and not on individual tokens, but instead on token classes. So the classification of the tokens is actually an important thing, because that gives the connection to the context-free grammars. We will see an example a little bit later on. But in general, the token classes give us the input alphabet for terminals in our context-free grammar. And apart from that, in the context-free grammar, we then describe the nesting structure of the language that we want to describe. So we need to talk about what context-free grammars actually look like. And yeah, there's the faces that you usually get when you talk about context-free grammars. So that's Chomsky and Backus. So Chomsky hierarchy and Backus null form are maybe ringing a few bells. Anyway, what makes up context-free grammar is usually a few components for by the number. So there's the set of non-terminals that are used to model the structure elements. There's the set of terminals that give you the connection to the token sequence that comes as an input. And then the actual set of rules that determine how the units, meaning non-terminals and terminals, interact with each other to create structure. And well, as the last but not least thing, there's definition of the start symbol that gives you kind of the idea of what the whole structure of an input file should look like. This is your entry point into the structure usually, and that should always go into the root node of the syntax tree that you have derived from a particular input. So for context-free grammars, the rules have a particular form, which is given here. So it looks like a singular non-terminal at the left-hand side, and a sequence of so-called symbols. Symbols are usually, strings from the, or sequences from the non-terminals mixed with terminals. And yeah, that's what rules are supposed to look like in context-free grammars. Particularly, you will never find a terminal on the left-hand side, and you will never find any other number of non-terminals than one on the left-hand side. Otherwise, you would have no context-free grammars, but a context-sensitive grammar. So, as an example for an input language, this is one that you might have seen in theoretical computer science a lot, since that is the, one of those that encode matching brackets. So you have production that gives you as its right hand side terminal A, another non-terminal S, and terminal B. Or another rule that is has as a right hand side, well, nothing, which we for purposes of identifying better just abbreviate with X. Okay, nice. So that gives us the language that matches the number of opening symbols with the same number of closing symbols, so brackets usually. For that example, you can already see I have applied a few kind of implicit conventions, so this helps you in deciphering the grammars that you will find later on. So usually my non-terminals are colored in green, and the terminals are colored in blue, and there's also, well, lowercase and uppercase make a difference for these one-letter abbreviations, and if it's multi-letter abbreviations, then I usually put these brackety things around if it's a non-terminal, and if it's a terminal it won't have something like that. So that should help you in reading these. So I think in theoretical computer science you've seen a lot of those kind of artificial grammars. Here now we have a practical example of how at least a fraction of a grammar of a real language might look like. So that is giving you kind of an excerpt of how the statements might be defined in language. So this is usually something similar to C or Java or something. So your root symbol tells you that statement is kind of the general non-terminal that is unfolded here. And statement looks like, well, you see, in principle, what we have seen so far would be, for example, the way of defining that as statement if or statement goes to while. And that is a thing that I combine into a single line by just reintroducing this variation operator. So that is nothing different to keeping them separate. It's just kind of combining them because they have the same left-hand side. So that is where these bars come from. It's just variation and gives you variations of right-hand sides. So a statement can expand to either an if non-terminal, a while non-terminal, or a rexp thing, whatever that might be, followed by a semicolon. You already know what it means? Yeah, well, it's not a regular expression so far, I can tell. So, if, for example, then... What?
What did that
in a minute. So, if unfolds into a typical if statement, like with the terminal symbol if, opening bracket, another one of those rexp things. Closing bracket, a statement for what happens if the condition matches, if the condition is true, else keyword, and statement when the condition is not fulfilled. While is pretty similar, there's a keyword, there's a condition in brackets, and a statement that is to be repeated. And now, rexp is not a regular expression. Instead, what it is actually a right-hand side expression, it's called. So it's supposed to be every expression that you can find on the right-hand side of an assignment. So it's usually a thing that produces a value. So an expression that can be evaluated is a right-hand side expression. You might ask what expression is not a right-hand side expression. We will see that in a bit, few moments. So, for example, what could be a right-hand side expression? Could be, for example, this is written int. In this particular case, what I mean with that is not the keyword int, but a terminal of type integer number. So, that would be a viable right-hand side expression. Or left-hand side expression. Or a thing like left-hand side expression is assigned by a right-hand side expression. It's assigned to from a right-hand side expression. So, and, well, whatever you might imagine right-hand side expressions are built from. So it could be arithmetic Boolean expression or whatever you might imagine as a right-hand side expression. And left-hand side expression, for example, could be name. Well, would usually be an identifier or something, or address of generation, or whatever you might consider to be a valid left-hand side expression. So that is kind of how these statements are realized in an example. Of course, it's just an excerpt. If you're interested in such things, you might get yourself the standardization document of the language of your choice. And if it's a nice language, then it offers something like that in form even of a grammar for something like C, C++, Java, whatever you might imagine as, well, also for Camel, for example. You can obtain these things in documents on the project's homepage, and with that you can explore what you can actually offer the compiler as valid syntax for your particular language. Especially for the for C, I must say, I'd had some quite interesting experiences when I read the actual grammar, what you could write as valid C code and whatnot. That was a few years back when I didn't know about this way of, for example, defining the type of your arguments outside of the arguments parentheses and all that. So there's quite a lot of funky things that you can actually offer as valid syntax to your compiler, and I would recommend when learning a new language to actually have a look at the grammar and explore what is actually possible to express in that particular language. Well, at least that's what a compiler construction guide or what does. Anyway, for the topics that come a little bit later on. More conventions. We have already said that we gather all the right-hand sides that are given for one left-hand side with this pipe operator, and then just enumerate them as kind of a list. If we want to point to a particular variation of production in this setting, it might be too long to produce the complete definition of the right-hand side and its left-hand side. In those cases, I will use an abbreviation like this, where I give you the tuple of the left-hand side symbol and the number, as the index of the variation that I'm referring to. That might be necessary in diagrams that are much larger than just one or two productions. So keep that in mind. I might also remind you that this is what I mean when you ask. But anyway, this is examples for grammars that you have seen probably in theoretical computer science a lot, because these are grammars that give somewhat small example of things that are relevant in the real world, particularly arithmetical expressions. So these are the expressions that are made from binary operators like plus and star, brackets, identifiers for names or constants. And you see these are two versions of grammars, and both grammars actually describe the same language, meaning they recognize the same input set. And yeah, that would be the numbering scheme, in case that you might wonder a little bit later on what I'm referring to. Anyway, what we need to talk about is how to read or interpret these grammars, and that's where derivations come into the play, because grammars can be seen as things like term rewriting systems. The rules that you're giving by, that you're given by a grammar constitute how you are meant to rewrite parts of a string. So what you can achieve with that is you can create sequence that consists in rewriting steps. So you start from some kind of string of symbols and rewrite them piece by piece to arrive at a different string of symbols. As an example, you could start from the string consisting just of E, and we are now in the world of these arithmetical expressions, particularly the second variant that we had. And we can now start and rewrite with the rules that we are given. E goes, for example, to, what was it? E plus T or something? Yeah, guessed right. So that was one of the rewriting steps that we can do. You see, I've underlined the E here because that was the point where my rewriting put a grip on, and this was replaced by the right-hand side of a rule. And you see in the other intermediate results, other non-terminals that are underlined, which are rewritten by the right-hand sides of rules that are set up for that particular non-terminal. So this E, for example, might be also rewritten by, well, what, maybe T, I don't know. Yeah, T. So here we might decide then to rewrite that particular T. I don't know what comes there. Maybe integer? No? T times F. So there you could, for example, also decide to rewrite that particular F thing over there, which would, for example, offer to be rewritten into an int. Then you could decide for T and so on. And with that, you could create a sequence of rewriting steps, which we would consider to be a derivation with respect to the rule set of that particular grammar. So with that, we could derive the string such an identifying name times integer number plus integer number to be something that would be derivable from our root symbol E. And yeah, with that, you have a typical product of that particular rule set, which would be then a valid arithmetical expression. So, as a definition, the derivation relation should have been a rewriting relation. So, one of these steps was a rewriting relation. So, that's misleading here, so it's not. Derivation is a sequence of such steps. Of course, a single step is also a sequence, so yeah. But in general, I would consider a chain of these rewriting steps to be a derivation, but thus also a single one is a derivation. It's a relation on words over N and T, which, well, words over N and T, that is kind of what I described as these strings. With, well, two of these strings being in derivation relation if The first string consisted of, at some point, a non-terminal A, and the second string consisted at, as the same components with, at the place where A had had been, now a beta. And these things need to be given to us by our set of productions. If that is the case, then we can consider this particular relation with respect to our grammar to be a valid relation. Yeah, and well, if I use several of these steps, I usually just denote the reflexive transitive closure by putting a star there. So, which basically means that I can do arbitrary steps of rewriting, and that is usually what I consider to be a derivation. So, yeah. What you've seen me saying quite verbosely a lot of times now is that, of course, a rewriting step is not always a rewriting step in general, because it's depending on an actual grammar rule to be present that that justifies that particular rewriting step. So it's depending on the actual grammar, and usually you would have to put the grammar in index somewhere, but we usually say that now we're looking at that particular grammar, and then we can leave away that particular thing. But to be absolutely loophole free, we'd have to put that as an index somewhere. To be clear, for this derivation, you have seen that I have just arbitrarily painted or underlined a non-terminal in there, and that is what you usually can do in such a derivation. You can choose a spot where you want to rewrite. And you can choose the particular rule that you want to rewrite with, and still we would call the whole thing to be a valid derivation. The language that such a grammar then specifies is, so we're now at the part of semantics, is all the possible derivations that you could think of. You would consider as valid, and the output that these things produce, in the sense that you consider something as an output if it is only composed of terminal symbols anymore, all these things make up the language that is considered to be the semantics for that particular context-free grammar. So, yeah, that's so much for semantics of that. Well, order in which disjunct fragments are rewritten is not relevant, of course. Well, they are independent in that sense, so it does not really matter whether to do one of those before the other, so it doesn't matter. Usually what we can use for illustrating derivations is derivation trees, and that's where now these abbreviation tuples come into play, where we have this non-terminal symbol and the index for the variation that we use for expanding or rewriting. So the derivation that you've seen before with these 0, 1, 0, 2, 1, 1, 1, 0, and so on, rewriting steps can be visualized as a tree, which in its subtree's roots carry the original symbol that has been rewritten by the variation that you find as second component of the tuple that makes up a node in that tree. And the children of that particular subtree are given by whatever is rewritten to at that particular point. So here, this E has been rewritten into E plus T. You can directly read that from the derivation tree. This E, this variation was variation 0. You can read that from that component over here. And from there on, you can then continue rewriting. So, for example, you could select the E over here to be rewritten. So that is this E, this is rewritten with 1, with variation 1, so that is put into here, which yields a T. This is this one over here that we will see here, and so on. And in that representation, it now doesn't matter anymore when independent symbols are rewritten. So it doesn't matter that E, which is this E, is rewritten before T, which is wherever is that T? This is over here, I think. So the actual order in which that happens doesn't matter anymore. The tree just looks like that anyway. It doesn't depend on the actual order in which this has been expanded. So, yeah. There, this explains once again what I've told you already. So, derivations are then classified into particular corner cases where we always do the rewriting in particular fashion. For example, the main things to take away there would be the leftmost and rightmost derivations. These ones, rightmost and leftmost derivations, that would always rewrite the leftmost occurrence of a non-terminal, or in case of the rightmost derivation, the rightmost occurrence of a non-terminal. So this chews up your intermediate product either from the right or from the left, and fills everything with terminals before it continues rewriting the rest of the input, or from the other way around, depending on what it is. And this is two famous special kinds of derivations that you need to remember when we talk about traversal of the derivation tree. If you do a depth-first traversal, we have this. We, for example, do a reverse rightmost derivation when we do a left-to-right post-order depth-first traversal on the derivation tree. So this is. We will see that a little bit later on, where that, where that comes into play. But that is where you have to look at when you are puzzled with these terms. So it's about derivations. In our example, we have, for example, as leftmost derivation, we would consider E. Well, there's no other way of derive there. We would derive next this E, this T, then the T1, the F1, then the F2, T1, and F2. So this was that first traversal with leftmost, and that gives you this linearization of rewriting steps. Rightmost derivation would be going E0, T1, F2, so E0, T1, F2, then E1, T0, E1, T0, F2, F2, T1, F1. This would be a rightmost step-first traversal. And last of all, the reverse rightmost derivation would be F1, T1, F2, T0, so F1, T1, F2, T0, then E1, still possible like that, then F2 and T1, like this, then E1, which would be kind of the bottom-up traversal through the whole thing, which means, that first post-order traversal, and yielding a reverse rightmost derivation. And on post order, I triggered my circlings. So start descending back up and descending in the tree. And when I re-ascended, I pulled the trigger on each of these things, and that's where the circles were created. That's the that first search post order. Well, this thing here, this reverse rightmost derivation, is just the reverse string of this rightmost derivation thing. So if you compare that, that's just string reversal in that sense. So that is why this is reverse rightmost derivation, not leftmost derivation. And it corresponds to always replacing the rightmost as a non-terminal. So, yeah, the only thing that still remains to say is then concatenating all the leaves of a derivation tree gives us a string of just terminals, which we call the yield of a derivation tree. And now we can define what it means when we say a unique grammar. A unique grammar means that for each possible yield of the derivation tree, there's only one derivation tree that will yield that particular string. So, yeah. In the, this helps us now in differentiating these two grammars, because the second one is unique, the first one is ambiguous in that sense. And yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, this is just, this top-down syntax tree reconstruction and bottom-up syntax tree reconstruction. For that, you have to go through these derivations that we have sketched before, and you will see this one will be a top-down way through the tree, this other one will be a bottom-up run through the tree. And with that, we are done with our context-free grammars, speeding up in the end a little bit, but I want to go to pushdown automaton next time and start fresh. And I think we can try to reflect the things that we've done here in this derivation part when it actually plays a role later on. So with that, I wish you a nice day, and we'll see us on Monday and Thursday, depending on which group you will take. So thank you.